From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater, another hour of sounds from radio's golden era. I'm Jake Longwell. We'll open today's program with an episode of 21st Precinct, one of many police dramas on radio in the 1950s based on actual cases from official police files. This broadcast, program number 37 in the series, originally aired on CBS Radio on March 24th of 1954, with Everett Sloan starring as Lieutenant Frank Kennelly. This episode is entitled The Package.
21st Precinct, Sergeant Tierney. Yes? What kind of bomb? Wait a minute, just a second, take it easy. In the art gallery where? Yeah.
You are in the muster room at the 21st Precinct, the nerve center. A call is coming through. You will follow the action taken pursuant to that call from this minute until the final report is written in the 124 room at the 21st Precinct.
No, don't do that. The officers will be right there. Yeah. Go outside on the sidewalk and wait for them. That's right.
21st Precinct. It's just lines on a map of the city of New York. Most of the 173,000 people wedged into the 9/10 of a square mile between Fifth Avenue and the East River wouldn't know if you asked them that they lived or worked in the 21st. Whether they know it or not, the security of their homes, their persons, and their property is the job of the men of the 21st Precinct.
The 21st, 160 patrolmen, 11 sergeants, and 4 lieutenants, of whom I'm the boss. My name is Kennelly, Frank Kennelly. I'm captain in command of the 21st. I was working my day tour, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. It was warm and sunny. After I turned out the platoon, I cleaned up the paperwork that had accumulated since I was last on duty 24 hours before. Then, after seeing 2 visitors in regard to their applications for gun permits, Sector Car Number 3 came by the station house for me, and I went on patrol of the precinct with Patrolman Eugene Dillon as operator.
Well, the kid comes home, Captain. He says to me, "Pop, you promised me this year I could have a new mitt."
Uh-huh.
Trappery one. You know, the new style for outfielders.
The movie house down on the next block, Dillon.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to stop in the candy store next one.
Yes, sir. Well, he's got it all picked out. Took me down to the sporting goods store. $13 for a mitt. $13.
That's a lot of money.
Well, it used to be the best mitt you could buy was $5 tops. $13. How do they expect anybody to spend $13 for a mitt for a kid? A 10-year-old. Says all the kids are getting them. I said, not 13 bucks, Buster. Not 13 bucks for a glove. Well, he was holding back the tears, Captain, and I started a weaken. And I thought his mother could use an Easter dress and I could use some shoes and... Well, the kid needs some clothes himself, so I said a big, final no.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of money for a glove.
Yes, sir, you're telling me.
I'll be out in a minute.
Yes, sir, Captain. Captain, hello.
Hello, Mr. Wolfsmith.
It's always a pleasure, Captain.
I stopped by to tell you that we're going to have to do something about that element that's beginning to hang out here at night, Mr. Wolfsmith.
What can you do? Soda, Captain?
No, thanks.
Not even a small chocolate?
Nothing, no thanks.
You think I want those kids in here, Captain? I don't want them. I try to discourage them. I don't let them read the magazines or the newspapers, but they come in here anyway. I don't want them. You tell me how to get rid of them. I'll be the first one to agree.
Well, the manager of the movie is complaining they're annoying the people on the way to and from the theater.
Captain, believe me, they annoy my regular customers. They annoy me. Who needs them for a 10-cent soda here and a nickel candy bar there? I don't need them. But every night, there they are. And to tell you the truth, I'm a little bit scared of them myself. These 14, 15-year-olds. Bullies. Puff talkers. You show me what to do, and I'll do it. Keep them away from here.
Yes, Dillon.
Call came over. I think you want to roll on.
Yeah?
Roadstone Gallery on Madison Avenue. They got a phone call. A bomb was left in the place.
Ah, a bomb?
All right, let's go. I'll be back later, Mr. Wolfsmith.
Bomb? That sounds like my element in here.
Go ahead, Captain.
Any other information?
No, sir. The dispatcher gave the call to Sector Cars 1 and 2. No other details.
Okay. You better go across and down Park.
Yes, sir.
$13.
What'd you say, Dillon?
I said $13, Captain.
$13 for a glove.
We made the run across and downtown. The traffic was heavy, and the Broadstone Gallery was in the exact opposite corner of the precinct. It took nearly 5 minutes. As we sped to the scene, I called to mind a picture of Broadstone. It was a combination auction room and art gallery. Good reputation. Large sales of estates and collections. Showings by famous painters and sculptors. Located on the ground floor of an apartment building. One large room with offices on a balcony. When we turned the corner into Madison Avenue, there were four police cars in the block. Cops were keeping the sidewalks clear in front of the gallery. The crowd was being held across the street and 50 feet on each side of the store.
Okay, Dillon, let's go.
Yes, sir. That's Sergeant Jackson, Captain.
Keep those people back. Get them across the street.
Sergeant?
Yes, sir, Captain.
Now, what do we got?
There was an anonymous phone call. The caller said he put a bomb in the place. There was an auction in progress. 40 or 50 people. We got them all out.
Any sign of a package or anything, Sergeant?
We haven't looked, Captain. The first job was to get the people out.
Good.
Well, what happened? Did you find anything?
We haven't looked yet. This is Captain Kennelly. Mr. Broadstone.
How do you do?
Well, this is absurd. It's really absurd. I can't think of any reason any person in his right mind would make such a call.
Well, maybe he's not in his right mind, Mr. Broadstone. Let's take a look inside, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
Dillon?
Yes, sir? It's a joke. Must be a joke.
Mr. Broadstone.
Yes?
You better get back behind the line.
Oh, but Captain...
Go ahead, please.
Yes, it's all right. Behind the line.
Everybody out, Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Signal those men to keep the people back until we come out.
Yes, sir. All right, Captain.
Let's go.
Dillon?
Yes, sir.
Have the detectives been notified?
Yes, sir. I rang in. The desk officer notified them.
Okay.
Those chairs were set up for the auction, Captain.
Mm-hmm.
The officers are upstairs in the back, on the balcony.
All right, let's take a look around. If you see anything, let it lay. Sergeant, take that aisle.
Yes, sir.
Dillon, left side.
Yes, sir.
I'll go down the center. Go ahead.
There's a room on the side there, Captain.
All right, we look at that last.
Yes, sir.
Anything, Dillon?
No, sir.
Somebody left an umbrella.
Captain.
Yes?
Under a chair, a package.
Don't touch it.
Don't worry. Through here, Captain, this row. There it is, Captain. See it?
Yeah.
That's just about the right size.
Just about the wrong size, you mean, Sergeant?
Yeah.
Well, it can't stay here.
No, sir.
Can you move that chair without disturbing it?
Yes, sir.
Easy. Oh, that's good. All right. Move that one, too, Dillon.
Yes, sir.
That's good.
Well, I don't hear anything ticking to you.
See that big, heavy carpet on the platform up there, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. It was being auctioned off.
If we get it under there, that'd hold any blast down to a minimum.
Yes, sir. We could fold the rug over the box a couple of times, but the rug is too heavy to carry over here.
All right. We take the box over there. Go on over, Sergeant. Lift the corner of the rug up.
Yes, sir. Let me know when you're ready.
I'll carry it over, Captain.
All right, Dillon. You ready, Sergeant?
All set.
Well,
easy now.
There's nothing. Oh, brother.
What's the matter?
Nothing's the matter, Captain. Everything's great. It doesn't weigh 2 ounces.
Everything all right, Captain?
Relax. Too light for explosives.
You know something, Captain?
What?
I think I'll buy that glove for my kid.
These days, $13 isn't so much.
We opened the cardboard box to examine the contents. Inside was a lady's hat, apparently left under the chair by an excited auction patron. By that time, Lieutenant Matt King, commander of the 21st Squad, had arrived on the scene with two of his detectives. Together, we conducted a thorough search of the premises. No trace of a bomb was found. The people were readmitted to the gallery, and upstairs in the office, Lieutenant King, Detective William Novak, and I began to talk to Mr. Ernest Broadstone, the owner of the gallery, and his secretary, Miss Helen McLeese.
Yes, sir. I was up here all alone. The auction was going on downstairs.
I see. And you, Mr. Broadstone?
Well, I was on the floor downstairs watching the auctioneer conduct the sale.
This was what time?
10:30, 10:35. Isn't that right, Helen?
Yes, sir, about.
The phone rang.
Yes, sir.
And you answered?
Yes, sir.
Where were you when you answered, Mr. McLeese?
Right outside at my desk there.
Can you remember exactly what the man said?
Well, not exactly, but pretty close.
What?
Well, I said, Broadstone Gallery, good morning, and he said he'd like to talk to Mr. Broadstone.
What tone of voice did he use, Miss McLeese?
What do you mean?
Well, was it high-pitched or low? Was he trying to disguise it?
Oh, no, I don't think so. He was using a normal voice. He was very polite, really very polite.
And what did you say after he told you he'd like to talk to Mr. Broadstone?
Well, I said Mr. Broadstone was very busy at the moment. He was downstairs on the auction floor. I wanted to take a message, and he said he had to talk to Mr. Broadstone right away. I told him that was impossible.
Uh-huh.
And he said it was very important. It's a matter of life and death. I didn't know what to do. So I told him to hold the wire, and I'd see if I could find Mr. Broadstone.
And that was the extent of your conversation with the man?
Yes.
Did it sound like anyone you know or had spoken to before?
Oh, no.
It sounded familiar in no degree?
No, sir.
Do you think you'd be able to recognize the voice if you heard it again?
Well, I couldn't say. I might be able to.
But when you went downstairs, Miss McLeese, did you leave the phone off the hook, lay it on the desk?
Oh, no, sir. You see, we had three lines. There's a button on the phone for each of the lines. Also, one for local. That's into office calls. And one for hold. I pressed the hold button and put the receiver back on the phone.
You went downstairs to find Mr. Broadstone?
Yes, I went downstairs to find Mr. Broadstone.
Where were you, Mr. Broadstone, when she found you?
Well, I was standing on the right-hand side of the gallery, observing the bidding on the particular item that was up for auction.
The right-hand side as you faced the door, or as you faced the rear of the room?
No, as you faced the rear of the room.
That's on the same side as the stairs leading down from the auction.
Yes, yes, that's right.
What did Miss McLeese say to you when she found you?
Well, essentially, the same thing she told you, that the man said it was a matter of life and death.
You decided to take the call.
Well, Lieutenant, I have a wife and children, a lot of friends. A matter of life and death can take in a lot of territory. So I went to the phone.
Did you come up here, upstairs, to take the call?
No, Captain, I stayed downstairs. I went to a little anteroom off the main gallery. We have an extension in there. The salesman's phone.
I see.
What was the conversation you had on the phone?
Well, I picked up the phone. I said hello. And he asked, is this Mr. Broadstone? I said yes. And I asked who it was calling. He said something like, never mind. And he told me there was a bomb in the place. Well, I thought somebody was kidding me.
Well, that's hardly something to kid about.
Yes, sir. That's what I told him. But he said he wasn't kidding and might go off any minute. Well, I started to ask him some questions, but he wouldn't talk to me. He hung up.
What did you do?
Well, I stood there for a minute. I didn't know exactly what to do. Whether to call the police first or get the people out. There were 50 or 60 people out there in the gallery at the auction. I decided to call the police first and not to tell the people. Let the police handle that. Because if I got up there and said there was a bomb in the place, there might be a mad rush for the door and somebody would be sure to get hurt or killed. But I couldn't believe, really, there was a bomb in the place. I thought somebody might be pulling a joke. So I called the police and went out to the sidewalk to wait for them.
Well, that was the wisest thing to do.
Oh, thank you. Well, the first ones got there almost as soon as I got outside, that sergeant. I explained to him what happened. Meanwhile, another police car came up, and they told me to stay on the sidewalk. They went in and handled the whole thing. They must have handled it fine because the people started walking out slowly, no disorder, pushing, anything like that. They did a good job, all right.
Well, Mr. Broadstone, did the voice of the man on the phone sound in any way familiar to you?
No, I can't say that it did.
Miss McLeese, you said he was extremely polite and rather well-spoken.
Oh, yes, that's right.
But did you get the same impression, Mr. Broadstone?
Yes, I did. His delivery was slow and even, I'd say even polite, yes.
How many employees do you have here, Mr. Broadstone?
Well, it was nine altogether, myself and Miss McLeese. Also upstairs in the office is the bookkeeper. She's across the hall. There's a porter and a shipping clerk and the four men on the floor.
Have they all been with you a long time? I hope you're not inferring that any of my employees is involved in this, Lieutenant. They were all here at the time.
I was thinking more of a former employee, Mr. Bledsoe.
Oh. Well, our turnover we have is very slight. Very slight.
Captain.
Yes, Sergeant.
The bookkeeper said there's a call from Mr. Bledsoe.
Well, tell her to take the message, will you?
The man says it's a matter of life and death.
Well, have the bookkeeper say he'll be right with him, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
No, back.
Yes, sir.
Get on another line outside.
Yes, sir.
See if you can find out where it's coming from. Go to the bookkeeper's phone.
Okay, Lieutenant. Right.
You're going to listen in, man?
Yes, Captain. Pick it up, Mr. McLeese. Take your time, but don't lose him. Turn him over to Mr. Bloodstone.
Now?
Yes, go ahead. I'm going to listen out at your desk.
Mr. Bloodstone's office? Yes. Who?
Okay, Matt. Okay, all set.
Just ask Mr. Bloodstone to come to the phone, please.
But I have to tell him who's calling.
You know very well who's calling. Now, please, I don't have much time.
Well, all right. Just a moment.
Hello? I just want to tell you, Mr. Bloodstone, it's still a matter of life and death.
Now, look, who is this?
It's me, Mr. Bloodstone. I spoke to you a little while ago.
I know you did, but this is a very poor excuse for a joke.
It's no joke, Mr. Bloodstone.
Well, we couldn't find anything in the gallery. We searched.
The police searched, didn't they? I wouldn't have called the police if I were you. You just made a fool of yourself.
Well, what did I do? You told me there was a bomb in the place.
I'm sorry about that. There really wasn't.
Well, I'd like to know why you did such a thing.
Oh, because I want something from you.
And what?
I want $5,000.
$5,000?
Please.
Why?
So I don't really put a bomb in your gallery. And next time, I will. If I don't get the money. Goodbye, Mr. Bronstone.
Wait.
I'm sorry. Goodbye.
Hello. Hello.
$5,000 he wanted. You heard him, Lieutenant, didn't you?
Yes, I heard him.
What do you think, Ben?
Sounds like a psycho to me, Captain.
I'm scared. I'm really getting scared.
Well, there's nothing to be afraid of, Miss McLeese.
Oh, well, you can say that. He didn't threaten to bomb the police station. He threatened to bomb my place of business.
Lieutenant.
Yes, Novak.
We couldn't trace the call. Didn't stay on long enough. Another minute and maybe we would have made it.
That's too bad.
Well, now how can you catch me, Captain? I don't see how you can possibly.
We will. This had to happen to me. Why did it have to happen to me?
Nothing's happened to you yet, Mr. Bloodstone. We'll try to see that it doesn't. Lieutenant King was soon convinced that the man we sought was not a professional extortionist. A telephone check with the Bureau of Criminal Information showed that no complaint of this type had been reported in a considerable period of time anyplace in the city, although extortion by threat to bomb was once quite common. He leaned rather to the theory that the call was from a disgruntled and psychopathic former employee, or a disappointed artist whose work had been turned down by Mr. Broadstone. Two detectives, assisted by employees, were set to work on the records of the gallery to look for just such possibilities. In addition, Mr. Broadstone was questioned closely about his personal life. The threat might have its basis there. Mr. Broadstone said he was happily married and went out with no other women. He could think of no enemies he had made through business dealings. He discounted entirely the possibility of a personal vendetta. Lieutenant King, however, instructed two of his detectives to make a thorough check to verify Broadstone's assertions. By noon, all the uniformed officers who answered the call had been instructed to resume patrol, and the case was left entirely in the hands of the detectives. I returned to my other duties. At 4 p.m., I turned out the platoon for the night tour, after which I worked with a 124 man at our first attempt to arrange the vacation schedule to the satisfaction of as many men as possible. At 6, I changed to civilian clothes, signed the blotter, and left the precinct to go off duty until the following day, when I walked into the station house at 3:30 p.m.
Hello, Captain.
Go ahead, take the call. I'll sign the blotter.
Yes, sir. 21st Precinct, Sergeant Jackson.
What's doing around here?
Not much, Captain. Pretty quiet, sir. Yes, sir. He just got in. Captain?
Yeah?
Lieutenant King wants to know if he can see you for a minute.
Yeah, sure. Before the turnout?
The captain wants to know before the turnout, Lieutenant. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right.
Is he coming down?
Yes, sir. He'll be right downstairs.
Okay.
There's some messages on your desk, Captain. I've got a couple more here.
Oh, thanks.
And Sergeant Collins went sick.
No? What's the matter with him?
His wife rang in. She says it looks like the virus. He's got a doctor coming.
Okay.
Is Lieutenant Snyder in the house yet?
I didn't see him come in, Captain.
Well, tell him to come into my office when he gets here.
Yes, sir.
I'll be in there.
Hello, Captain.
Oh, Matt, come in.
Thanks.
Sit down, Matt.
Yeah, thanks. I want to talk to you about that bomb case at Broadstone Gallery, Captain.
Yes, Matt. How are you doing on it?
Nothing. I haven't heard from the boy again.
No?
No, sir. I've had two men planted over there around the clock. I've had a man planted at Broadstone's apartment building.
Well, how does his story check out?
Oh, he's all right. No women. Pretty square dealer in business. No enemies that we could find. Good reputation all around.
Mm-hmm. Well, how can I help you, man?
Well, the squeals are piling up on me, Captain. I've had almost the whole squad tied up in this thing since yesterday morning. I've got two men planted over at the gallery now. They closed at 6 o'clock. Last night, I had men sitting outside in the car all night. I want to pull them off.
Yeah?
This guy's a psycho for sure. If he's going to put a bomb in there, he won't do it at night. I don't think. But just in case, what I'd like is for you to instruct your men on post over there and the sector men to take a look as often as they can.
Yeah, sure, man. But what are you going to do when they open up tomorrow?
Well, I'll send a couple of my best hawkshaws over there when they open up in the morning.
All right, man, I'll give the instructions. Excuse me. 21st Precinct, Captain Kennelly.
Sergeant Jackson on TS, Captain. Novak is ringing you for Lieutenant King.
All right. Novak for you, man.
No, thanks. He's one of them over there. Lieutenant King. Lieutenant King.
Novak, Lieutenant.
Yeah, what is it, Novak?
Mr. Broadstone got a letter from the bombardier.
Just now?
Well, he was out this afternoon. He just got back. When the letter came, his secretary put it on his desk unopened. It was marked personal.
What did it say?
Just a second, Lieutenant. No, that's all right. I can see it. Made up of words cut out of a newspaper and pasted down. It says, deliver $5,000 by tonight at midnight. You must not fail. As I said, this is a matter of life and death.
That's all?
Yes, sir, that's all.
Well, how do we know where the money is supposed to be delivered?
Oh, that's no problem, Lieutenant. He signed his name and address.
After getting further details over the phone, Lieutenant King instructed Novak to bring Mr. Broadstone and the letter into the station house. In the meantime, I turned out platoon for the night tour at 4 p.m., giving special instructions to the men concerned to keep a close watch on the Broadstone galleries during the night. Lieutenant King told me the letter was signed Carlton Adbury. The address given was the Pleasant Apartment House on Madison Avenue, not too far from the Broadstone galleries. When Detective Novak and Mr. Broadstone arrived at the station house, they were directed to my office where Lieutenant King was waiting.
Come in.
Thank you.
You remember Captain Snelly, Mr. Broadstone?
Yes, of course.
Sit down, Mr. Broadstone.
Yeah.
Where's the letter?
I got it, Lieutenant.
Captain. Oh, thanks, man.
Broadstone, do you know anyone named Carlton Adbury?
No.
Ever heard of him?
No, I can't say I have. Does it sound familiar?
No, not at all, Lieutenant. If there is such a person, how could he be so foolish as to sign his name? That's the first question I'm going to ask him. But I'm grateful to him. Don't misunderstand me.
Then you really think he's the right one? The story was in all the newspapers. Couldn't it be some crank, another person entirely? There are people like that. I've read about
them. I've handled them, Mr. Broadstone. I read all the newspaper stories. Not one of them mentioned the fact that the man consistently referred to this as a matter of life and death.
Oh.
I think this is the right man.
With Lieutenant King, Detective Novak, and Detective Whitey Howard, I left the precinct house a few minutes later. We drove to the Madison Avenue address given in the letter received by Mr. Broadstone. On arrival there, we asked for the manager of the apartment building. He was out. The elevator operator told us that a Mr. Carlton Adbury did in fact live in the building. He said that Mr. Adbury was a man of about 40, perhaps a little older. He had a reputation of being rather eccentric in his habits. He would stay in his apartment for days, or he would leave without luggage and not return for days. As far as the doorman knew, Mr. Adbury was in no financial difficulty. It was rumored he had an independent income. We had the doorman get the passkey and take us up.
There it is.
That one.
Al.
He hasn't gone off on one of his three-day jaunts, man.
I don't think so. He's waiting for the $5,000.
You want to try it again?
Yeah?
Mr. Carlton, Matt, Brian?
Yes, just a moment. Yes,
sir. Oh. Did Mr. Broadstone send you, gentlemen?
In a way, yes.
Well, please come in. Have you been standing here long? I didn't hear the door at first, the electric razor, you know. Well, there's so many of you. Won't you come in the living room?
Now, that's Howard.
Yes, sir, Lieutenant, I got you.
Where are they going?
Just to look around.
Oh. Well, it's a very attractive apartment. Did you bring the money?
No.
You didn't? But that was my understanding with Mr. Broadstone.
We're police officers.
But I need the money.
How did you happen to pick on Mr. Broadstone? Why should he give it to you?
Well, because I need it.
But why him? Where have you been getting it up until now?
From the bank. But they won't send me anymore. They said I have to go back to the hospital. And that's not fair, is it? It's my money. It was left to me by my mother. Why shouldn't they send it to me? I don't have to go back to the hospital just because they say so. I don't like it there.
What made you think Mr. Broadstone should give it to you?
Because I walked past his gallery every day. And every day there were different paintings in the window. Never the same. Always different. I don't want to go back to the hospital.
Why did you threaten to leave a bomb in a place?
If I didn't, why else would he give me the money? Had to be a reason. Has to be a reason for everything.
Nothing back there, Lieutenant.
Okay.
I don't want to go back to the hospital. Do I have to? Is that where you're going to take me?
Where's the stuff you were going to make the bomb out of?
Oh, I wasn't going to make a bomb. I really wasn't. I knew I wouldn't need to if I frightened him enough.
Did you think of what would happen to you if you didn't frighten him at all?
Yes. But what difference did that make? I was going back to the hospital anyway.
Well, I guess you will. After a few stops on the way.
21st Precinct, Sergeant Tierney.
Yeah.
What is it you lost?
Briefcase, huh?
Yeah. Well, where'd you get out of the taxi?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it goes, around the clock, through the week, every day, every year. A police precinct in the city of New York is a flesh and blood merry-go-round. Anyone can catch the brass ring, or the brass ring can catch anyone.
21st Precinct, a factual account of the way the police work in the world's largest city, is presented with the official cooperation of the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, an organization of more than 20,000 members of the Police Department, City of New York. Everett Sloan in the role of Captain Kennelly, Ken Lynch as Lieutenant King. Featured in tonight's cast were Jan Owen, Terry Cotter, Bill Lipton, Don McLaughlin, Ken Delmar, and Ivor Francis. Written and directed by Stanley Niss. Produced for CBS Radio by John Ives. Art Hanna speaking.
21st Precinct, program number 37 in that series, The Package, from March 24th, 1954. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch with the program, our email address is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And if you want more info about the radio theater, such as detailed playlists or streaming audio, then please visit our blog and website at qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. This is Upstate Radio Theater Program 1540. We'll turn to some classic science fiction to wrap up the hour, and an episode of Tales of Tomorrow. This series was both a radio and television series on ABC in the early 1950s. Unfortunately, not very many episodes of the radio series survive, and the ones that do are not the best audio quality. But I think it's well worth a listen, as this is sci-fi at its very best. The story, taken from the pages of Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Later on in the 50s, the stories in Galaxy would be the basis for many of the scripts on X-1. This broadcast of Tales of Tomorrow, program number 8 in the series, from February 19th, 1953, starring Leon Janney. It's entitled Watchbird.
Do you lock the front door and check the windows before you go to sleep? Of course you do.
Because all of us are naturally afraid of violence, murder. But imagine, if you can, a civilization wherein homicide has been eliminated by a mechanical device. No more shootings, no more strangulations, no more killings of any kind. That's the kind of civilization our descendants may enjoy in the next century. Sounds great, doesn't it? And yet the effect is murder. I think you'll see what I mean as we listen to a remarkable tale from Galaxy Magazine, a story called Watchbird.
Gelson speaking.
Gelson, this is John Monroe.
Yes, Chief?
It's happened, Fred. By George, it's finally come through.
What, you mean you got the go-ahead from Washington?
The green light, complete with trimmings. With consent of Congress, the President has ordered watchbird divisions for every city and town in the country. He's given us top priority on strategic metals, manpower, and every kind of electronic equipment we'll need. Well, now, how does that sound to you?
Oh, great, Chief. Just great.
This is our chance, Gelson. A chance to strike a blow not just for Watchbird Incorporated, but for all humanity. Now, how soon can you get those assembly lines rolling?
We're all tooled up and ready to go. The first Watchbirds, Model X2, should be coming off the assembly lines within a week.
Good. Remember, Gelson, we're making history, so make the fur fly. If there's anything you need, don't hesitate to call on me.
I'll do that, Chief. Goodbye. Hey, Mac, have you got a bottle of good whiskey stashed away in your desk?
Well, it so happens I have, but what's the occasion?
Washington just flashed us the okay, Mac. That crime-killing bird you designed will soon be in the air. It won't be long before the crime of murder is a thing of the past. That's how it seemed to me, Fred Gelson, vice president in charge of production of Watchbird Incorporated, on the morning of March 26th in the year 2003. That's how it seemed to all of us. Hadn't Jed McIntyre, our chief engineer and one of the finest scientists in the country, testified before a special commission set up by the President of the United States?
To sum up, gentlemen, we have in the Watchbird a mechanical flying policeman capable of staying aloft for months at a time. The Watchbird's electronic brain is tuned to the peculiar brain waves thrown off by the potential murderer. With its tremendous speed, the Watchbird can reach the murderer before he puts his criminal impulse into action. And with its electrical immobilizer, the Watchbird can stop the act of violence before it takes place.
The commission had been impressed by McIntyre. And 1 month after we got our go-ahead, the Watchbirds were installed all over the country. On a given date, they were released simultaneously into the sky. We followed the bird assigned to our district by televiewer and radar. Over the city, the Watchbird soared, its aluminum hide glistening in the sun. Then something happened. The bird spun into a dive. Its electronic brain had picked up a murder wave from below. Built-in kinesthetics guided the Watchbird in the direction of the killer, a small man standing in an alley waiting for his victim. He didn't see that streak of aluminum lightning rushing toward him until it was too late. Before he could raise his gun to fire at the Watchbird, a bolt of man-made lightning knocked the gun from his hand. He scrambled for it, but before he could reach it, the Watchbird knocked him flat on his back. He lay there helpless, immobilized, with the bird hovering over him until the police arrived and took him away. The Watchbird had prevented its first murder. Headlines, of course, in all the newspapers. Photographs of the Watchbird in action. An interview with the would-be killer and another with John Monroe, who claimed that the millennium had arrived. Just about the only people in town who weren't hailing the advent of the Watchbird era were Jim Spinner, the chief of police, and Norma, my wife. Jim had come over to play chess that evening, but his mind wasn't on the game.
Huh? Well, what did you say, Fred?
Said it's your move.
It is? I can't concentrate. I've been thinking of those blasted watchbirds. Those things have got me worried.
Well, you saw the birds in action today, Jim. What is there to worry about?
That's it. I don't know.
Jim's right, Fred. There's something peculiar about mechanical birds flying around, knocking people down with electrical immobilizers.
People? You mean killers, don't you, Norma? Now, don't be old-fashioned, dear.
Well, old-fashioned or not, I
still... Oh, say, there's a special watchbird broadcast on right now. Switch on the set, will you, dear?
All right. You can laugh at me as much as you like, Fred, but I don't care for the idea of electronic gadgets taking the law into their own hands.
Isn't that just like a woman? Taking the law into their own hands. Those birds are our agents.
This is Washington. At this time, we have a report here, a roundup report from the first day of National Watchbird Operation. And the news tonight is very good indeed. For the country as a whole, the rate of homicide has dropped 38%. In every case where watchbirds reach the criminal, the
Turn
crime
off,
was
Fred.
Prevented.
Wait, I want to hear this.
Here's Turn it off. You ain't getting all that in the morning newspapers.
Pennsylvania, homicide
you know,
down
I just
27%.
What it is about the watchbirds that bothers me.
Yeah,
Ohio down.
Fred, this wonder bird of yours has electronic learning circuits in addition to all the others, hasn't it?
That's right. The watchbirds are built to respond to certain stimuli and to carry out certain operations when they receive that stimuli.
And the learning circuits.
Yes, I'm coming to that. Only certain murderers give out these stimuli. Without learning circuits, the watchbird would only be 70% efficient. To stop all murders, the watchbird has to search out new definitions of murder and correlate them with what it already knows. See?
I see this much. You've given a mechanical device the power to think and learn. And I don't like it, Fred. I don't like it.
Complaints like Jim's were few and far between in the early days. How could you complain with the homicide rate going down 50% and more? It began to seem as though the boss's prediction about the millennium might come true. But then a flaw appeared. Jim Spinner phoned and asked me to meet him at the city morgue. What's up, Jim?
Plenty. I'll show you in a minute. You hear about that fellow Walker who tried to kill his wife this morning out in Sunnydale?
Did I? The afternoon papers are full of it. Watchbird did a great job in that case, Jim. Stopped that man dead in his tracks.
Dead is right. I want you to have a look at his body. Here we are.
Well?
Now look close, Fred. What do you suppose was the cause of death?
How should I know? Heart attack caused by fright?
No. The coroner tells me death was caused by electrocution.
What?
Walker was trying to strangle his wife when the watchbird appeared. But he wouldn't let go when the bird fired its first immobilizer charge at him, so the bird kept on shooting till he was dead.
I see.
You still think there's nothing to fear from this contraption of yours?
Well, look, Jim, it's pretty clear how this happened. The watchbirds are constructed to protect the victim of violence at whatever cost to the murderer. That bird was only following orders.
By taking the law into its own hands? By killing?
Well, that's unfortunate. But see here, suppose Walker had succeeded in killing his wife and was arrested for it. What would have happened to him?
He would have been electrocuted at the state prison.
Exactly, Jim, exactly. This way, the bird did the job for you. What's the difference?
The difference is this. When the state condemns a killer, it's only after due process of law. A jury of men decide, and after that, a man pulls the switch. But this way, it's inhuman.
Yeltsin speaking.
Fred, this is John Monroe. Come into my office, please.
I'll be right there, Chief.
Sit down, Yeltsin. Fred, I've called you and Mac in because we're up against a bit of a problem. These blasted watchbirds have gotten some peculiar ideas into their heads lately. Here, read this, Yeltsin.
Yeah, National Association of Slaughterers and Meat Packers.
Yes.
Dear sir, it has come to our attention by way of reports from member companies that watchbirds have been interfering recently with the orderly operation of their slaughterhouses. On numerous occasions, the birds have attacked workers slaughtering cattle. And in several other instances...
That's the gist of it.
The watchbirds won't let the slaughterhouse workers do their job. How do you account for that, McIntyre?
Sounds like the trouble is in the learning circuits. Look, Mr. Monroe, we provided the watchbirds with learning circuits to make them more efficient. Every day, their thinking centers correlate new facts that they've learned about murder. Now, apparently, they've come to the conclusion that slaughtering cattle is murder.
I think I've got the answer, Chief. We figured the watchbirds would think of murder as we do. But they don't think. They merely react to stimuli.
Is that right, Mac?
I'm afraid so, Chief. We should have defined murder very carefully and precisely when we installed the learning circuits. As it is, the birds are making their own definition.
Well, this is a fine time to discover it. Why didn't you think of it? Hello. Yes, speaking. Who? Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. How do you do, Mr. Monday? What's that? Say that again, sir. Well, that's impossible. Look here, sir. I'm in a conference right now. Can I call you back in half an hour, sir? Good. Yes, I'll certainly do that, sir. Goodbye. You know who that was, McIntyre? Mr. William Monday, head of the United States Department of Fisheries.
Well, what did he want, Chief?
A flock of watchbirds gathered over Gloucester Harbor this morning. They won't let the fishing boats put out to sea.
Well, it stands to reason, Chief. Watchbird reason, anyway, that if slaughtering cattle is murder, why shouldn't commercial fishing be murder, too?
Oh, but this is ridiculous. It's insane. Monday is ready to blow his top. The biggest fishing port in the United States is tied up by those birds, and he wants to know what we're going to do about it.
Now, take it easy, Chief. It's nothing to get alarmed about. We'll just have to adjust the thinking circuits and make the watchbirds more discriminating.
And how long will that take?
Well, the birds operate independent of any central control, you know. They come back once a week for a repair checkup. We'll just have to adjust them one at a time.
One at a time? But what about the slaughterhouse people and the Gloucester fishermen and the United States government breathing down my neck? I promised to call Monday back in half an hour.
They'll all have to wait until the birds come in, Chief. Until then, there's not a blessed thing we can do about it.
Developments on the watchbird situation. For the third straight day, rampaging watchbirds have kept the United States in a state of confusion and panic. In New York City, a crucial operation was interrupted by a watchbird which refused to permit the physicians to continue surgery. At the Pennsylvania State Prison, the electrocution of a condemned convict was halted by a watchbird which immobilized the executioner. After meeting this afternoon with the President of the United States, Mr. John Monroe, Watchbird Incorporated, stated that,
Fred, I was listening to it.
I can tell you what Monroe said. I wrote the statement for him. We're proceeding with countermeasures as fast as we can. As though that'll help much.
But didn't you say McIntyre has worked out a limiting circuit?
Yes, but even so, we won't be able to do anything until the first of the watchbirds comes in for their weekly checkup on Friday. Oh, when I think how smug and cocky I was a month ago. Well, I've learned my lesson. The world was better off before those blasted birds were invented.
I'm afraid the whole country has learned a lesson. Fred, why don't you ask Mr. Monroe to ground the watchbirds permanently?
I did, but he won't hear of it. He says a minor adjustment of the circuits and everything will be fine.
Hold still, Fred.
Why?
There's a mouth on your shoulder. Oh, wait, I'll get a newspaper.
Hold it, Norma. Don't touch that newspaper.
How will it be affected?
Now, never mind. There's a watchbird outside the window.
Oh, good heavens.
Now, sit down, dear. Sit down and get all thoughts of killing that moth out of your mind, and maybe that darn bird will go away. Well, there it goes.
Oh. Oh, Fred, thank heavens.
Gotta be careful with those things around, Norma. Very careful. Hello?
Fred, this is Jim Spinner.
Hello, Jim. Well, go ahead and say it. You told me so, all right.
That's not what I called about. Have you heard the latest?
You mean that execution that was stopped at the Pennsylvania State Prison?
No. This just came over the teletype here at police headquarters. A man named Olson tried to park his automobile a half an hour ago in the center of town. He was about to switch off the engine when a watchbird hit him. He tried again, and the watchbird hit him again. This time for keeps. Fred? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Jim. What can I say? What was there to say? The watchbird had reasoned perfectly, but not in human fashion. An automobile was a moving, functioning organism, therefore it was alive. To shut off the engine seemed to the watchbird like killing it. Therefore, the right of an automobile engine to go on running must be protected, even if the driver died. It went on like that. Cars, trucks, buses, and planes were forsaken by their drivers. No one would dare start an engine for fear of the danger involved in stopping it. Farmers stopped plowing the fields because the watchbirds had decided the earth was full of living organisms which had to be protected. The entire country was tied up. It was monstrous, madness, and nothing could be done about it. Something had to give.
Gelson?
Yes, Chief.
Well, you're going to have your way about the watchbirds. Adjusting the learning circuits won't be enough. Tell the service boys to ground them permanently as they come in. That's orders from the White House.
On Friday morning, I got to the service center early. I wanted to be the first man there when the watchbirds came in. But McIntyre was there before me, lying on the floor.
Fred, sure I'm glad you're here. Help me up.
Sure. Are you all right?
Oh, I think so. No bones broken anyway.
Well, what happened, Mac?
It was a watchbird.
What?
It was waiting on the floor when I got here. So I went to work disconnecting the kinetic system from the thinking center. But before I could pull a single vital tube, the thing let go with a blast from its immobilizer and knocked me out.
And the bird?
When I came to, it was gone.
But why, Mac? I don't understand it. They don't have any sense of self-preservation.
They don't need any sense of self-preservation, Fred. They've got something just as good. Didn't the watchbirds come to the conclusion that automobiles and so forth are living organisms, even though they are made of metal, because they run?
That's right.
That watchbird must have applied the same logic to itself. It could fly. It even had a kind of a thinking brain. Therefore, it must be a living organism, compelled to protect itself from murder.
Well, what are we going to do?
Nothing. I don't think any more watchbirds will come in for a checkup. That bird will warn all the others to stay away. We might as well go home.
I'll hate to face my wife with this news.
Your wife, eh? We've got to face the entire country.
Where's McIntyre? By heaven, Gelson, where's McIntyre?
He was notified of the meeting, Chief. He should be here any minute.
Are you sure no birds came in for checkup? Are you absolutely certain?
Only the first one, Chief.
Oh, then we're licked. Mac, where have you been?
Trying to figure a way out of this thing.
Have you come up with anything? Do you have any suggestions?
Only one. Without repairs, the watchbirds are bound to run down.
How long would that take?
Oh, about 6 months.
6 months? You call that a solution?
It's the only one I could think of, Chief.
Don't you realize the country's at a standstill? In 6 months, we'll have starvation here.
Unless we can think of a way to bring them down sooner.
Some way to bring... That's the idea, Mac. Couldn't you design a super watchbird that does everything the watchbirds do and does it better? And couldn't you fix its thinking center so that it would hunt down the watchbirds and destroy them?
A hunter watchbird, eh? Yes, like a hawk.
That's the idea.
Chief, I think you've got something. Yes, sir, that sounds like a workable solution.
Work on it, Mac. Put the entire research and development staff to work on it. You've got to come up with something fast.
And that's how the Hawks were born. It took McIntyre less than a week to build the prototype of the Hawk. He showed it to us on the floor of the factory.
As you see, Mr. Monroe, the Hawk is more heavily armored than the watchbird. By the use of new tubes, we've been able to increase its speed by 40%. Its immobilizer guns are designed to kill. And the Hawk's learning circuits are specially designed for hunting.
Splendid, McIntyre, splendid. Gelson, how soon can you get the Hawk into mass production?
I'm against it, Chief.
What?
The plan is no good.
Don't you think it will work?
Oh, it'll work all right. But I'm afraid the cure will be worse than the disease. Haven't we learned yet? Don't you see, Mr. Monroe, we can't cure human problems by mechanization.
Mr. Gelson, I would enjoy hearing you philosophize, but unfortunately, people are being killed. Crops are being ruined. Unless the watchbirds are stopped, the country faces famine.
Didn't we once say that murder had to be stopped? And look what that got us into. I tell you, Chief, this isn't the way.
Very well, Gelson. What would you suggest?
Let the watchbirds run down by themselves.
But that'll take 6 months.
Gelson, are you serious?
Let's face it. Admit we were wrong trying to cure human problems by mechanical means. These hawks
aren't... Ridiculous! Gelson, you've been working too hard. Maybe you want to take a week off.
As you say, Chief.
Well, wait a minute. I didn't mean right now. We can't spare you until you put the hawks into production. The assembly lines must be rolling by the first of next week. Is that clear?
I'll do my best, Chief. Ten days later, the first batch of hawks were released. From the top of the tallest building in the city, I watched the first encounter between a hawk and a watchbird. The watchbird was soaring over the housetops, unaware of the hawk overhead. Suddenly, a power bolt from the hawk slammed into the watchbird's wing. The watchbird was hurt, but it fought back. It had time to fire one bolt at the hawk, a bolt that bounced harmlessly off the hawk's heavily insulated body. And then the hawk zeroed on the watchbird and hit it with the full force of its firepower.
Turning now to the watchbird plague, the news today is favorable. To date, the hawks have destroyed 4,023 watchbirds, leaving only 780 to go. Here is a special report just handed to me. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrible. In Boston, Massachusetts, a hawk went berserk this evening, killing 47 people. The toll of death might have been far larger.
Hello? No, I don't want to speak to him. Look, Miss Evans, I don't want to talk to anybody. Just say you can't locate me.
Who's that, Chief?
Washington Justice Department. This is incredible. Isn't there anything you can think of, McIntyre?
I don't know what to say, Chief. More than 1,000 people killed so far this week.
Maybe another bird, something that would hunt down the hawks.
Your next gadget would have to be even more self-sufficient and murderous. Haven't you learned yet, Chief?
You're right, Gilson, you're right. But why? How did this happen?
It's simple. The hawk is a murder machine with improved learning circuits. But all it learns is more and better ways to kill. Since the hawk has to kill and all the watchbirds have been wiped out, the hawks have turned their attention to human beings.
Heaven help us.
This is what comes of giving a machine the job that was our responsibility in the first place.
Fred? Fred, is that you?
Yes, dear.
Oh, dear, I'm so relieved that you got home safe with those terrifying hawks up there in the sky.
I know, dear. Anyone hurt in the neighborhood?
Fred, Mrs. Matthews was almost killed.
No.
Yes, she just stepped out the front door when a hawk dived at her. She got back into the house and slammed the door just in the nick of time.
Well, she was lucky.
Lucky? Oh, you bet she was. Fred, we aren't going to have much for dinner tonight.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm not very hungry.
I was afraid to go shopping. I'm afraid to leave the house.
I don't blame you.
Well, you can have
scrambled
eggs and...
Wait a minute, Norma. Wait a minute. You've given me an idea. Hold everything.
What? What sort of an idea? Fred, who are you phoning?
McIntyre.
Hello?
Mac, this is Fred Gelson.
Oh, hello, Fred. Glad to see you got home okay.
Well, that's what I'm calling you about. Now, Mac, listen. Those hawks are constructed to kill. They've got to kill. Now, isn't that right?
Right.
Now, what would happen if they couldn't find anything to kill? No human beings, livestock, horses, anything like that.
Well, they'd turn to killing each other, I guess.
That's my idea, Mac.
What's that?
If the entire country were to stay at home behind locked doors and shuttered windows for a couple of days, we could get rid of this plague. The hawks would exterminate each other.
Well, yes, I think they probably would. But getting 200 million people to stay at home, how could that be arranged?
Easily, Mac. By presidential proclamation.
Proclamation issued by the White House today reads as follows. By the authority vested in me, I, the President of the United States, call on all residents of the United States to remain indoors during the 3 days commencing at sunrise, August 10th, and ending at sunrise, August 13th. During this period, no one is to leave his home for any reason.
On the night of August 9th, Monroe, McIntyre, and I slept at the factory. Like everyone else in the country, we'd prepared enough food the last 3 days. On the morning of August 10th, the life of the country came to a standstill. All city streets were deserted. And in the countryside, all livestock was safe in the barns. We were at the teleset in Mr. Monroe's office, waiting to see what the Hawks would do when they discovered that their potential victims had disappeared.
Monroe, Fred, look at the vid screen.
What is it, Mac? By heaven, those Hawks are in a fight.
I'll say they are. They're hitting each other with everything they've got. They can't last long at that rate, Mac.
No, I don't think they can. Look, Fred, one of them must have been hitting a vital spot. Yes, there he goes. He's going down.
For 3 days and nights, there was war in the sky. War without mercy as Hawks destroyed each other. The sky was full of man-made lightning as Hawks dueled and shot each other down. On the morning of the fourth day, when people emerged from their homes, the landscape was littered with aluminum shells and fire-blackened tubes and wires. But the skies were clear, not a hawk in sight. We had saved ourselves from ourselves.
That's it. Watchbird by Robert Sheckley, thanks to wonderful Galaxy magazine, now on the stand. Next week, another extraordinary tale of tomorrow out of Galaxy magazine called Inside Earth by Paul Anderson. The story of an interplanetary agent provocateur whose job was to stop rebellion by starting a revolution. This is your host, O-Mentor. Until next week, then, be kind to all birds.
Tales of Tomorrow. Heard in tonight's play were Leon Janney as Gelson, George Kluge as Monroe. Others in the cast were Mary Michael, John Raby, and Gerald Keane. Special sound effects by Ed Blaney and Bob Prescott. Technical supervision by Joe Durante. Your host, O-Mentor, was Raymond Edward Johnson. Music composed and conducted by Bobby Christian. Script adaptation by Michael Sklar. Produced by ABC in association with George Foley and directed by Warren Somerville.
Tales of Tomorrow, an episode entitled Watchbird, program number 8 in the radio series from February 19th, 1953. If you have a chance, check out not only the radio series, but also the television series, Tales of Tomorrow. It's in the public domain, so many video websites have the full series available for free, and it was one of the earliest attempts that I know of at science fiction on television, and the TV episodes are comparable to the radio series, in my opinion. Tales of Tomorrow. And with that, we come to the end of this hour of Old Time Radio. I'm Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for your company. Join me again soon, won't you, for another hour of sounds from radio's golden age. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.